All right. So this is June 8th, right? 2011. Emmerich Hansen, and I'd like to talk with you tonight about forming community. And I'm going to stay seated if that's okay, because I've got some readings I want to offer from the Buddha, and that are relevant to this. And when I talk about forming community tonight, I'm speaking both of spiritual community. And that's certainly a lot of the emphasis of the Buddha's teachings. And yet I would also like to talk about general community, how we form community with our partner, our own parents, our children, our own citizens on the planet for the welfare of people worldwide. How do we form community at work? How do we form community with our friends? Right? How do we, in a certain kind of sense, form community even with our own bodies? How do we come home to our bodies, our minds, our hearts, the people we live with, the people we work with, the people we share this very fragile and battered old planet with? How do we actually do that? So that's what I hope to explore with you tonight. And the Buddha's teachings, which are certainly about community in the holy life, as he called it, are also very relevant to those other forms of community, as I think you'll see. And he spoke to those other forms of community as well. So to begin with, I'm going to read to you if I could. And by the way, I'm of a mood tonight to go back to the source a fair amount. There's something about the original texts, as best we can understand what they were, of the Buddha's teachings that, for me at least, just have a wonderful resonance and power and even majesty to them. And I think it's important, if you're at all interested in Buddhism, to engage those texts. They're clear in a good translation. They're very accessible. Once in a while, you want to read a footnote to kind of really get a deeper understanding of something. But they're really useful. So that's what I think. See for yourself.
Okay. What text are you reading from?
This particular book is a really great anthology. I really recommend it. It would be my, if I'm stuck on a desert island for the rest of my life, Buddhist book. So this particular one is In the Buddha's Words by Bhikkhu Bodhi. And this passage in particular is from the a collection of the Buddha's discourses called the Samyutta Nikaya. That's just the detail of it. Okay, so this is the passage you may have heard before, where the Buddha is talking with Ananda. Ananda is his cousin and attendant, the one who has a great memory. And Ananda says, "Thus have I heard." That's Ananda talking. He said, "On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was dwelling among the Sakyans, where there was a town of the Sakyans named Nagaraka. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said, 'Venerable Sir, this is half of the spiritual life. That is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship.'" Half of the holy life. Community. Buddha says, with an exclamation point, "Not so, Ananda. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire spiritual life, Ananda. That is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a person has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that this person will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." So we have community as an end in its own right, as well as a means to the end of full enlightenment, full awakening, which is the result, ultimately, of the Noble Eightfold Path in the Buddha's framework here. And he says further, "And how, Ananda, does a monk with a good friend, how does a person with a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path?" And then he names the Eightfold Path. Here, Ananda, a person develops right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. It is in this way that a person with a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path. He goes on to say, related to this. By the following method too, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire spiritual life, the entire path of growth in the Buddhist frame is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. By relying upon me as a good friend, Ananda, by relying on the historical Gautama, and by relying on the awakening moving through that human individual, by relying upon me as a good friend, being subject to birth are freed from birth, being subject to aging are freed from aging, being subject to death are freed from death, being subject to sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair are freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, and despair. By this method, Ananda, it may be understood how the entire spiritual life is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. So widening that, you might imagine to yourself how much of what you personally care about in life, whatever that is, both general and concrete. You know, in other words, what you care about in terms of, let's say, happiness or health, or concretely care about, dishes getting done, kids put in bed, you know, businesses making a profit, roofs getting fixed, neighbors being agreeable about dealing with fallen trees. I've been dealing with one of those recently. And we have very agreeable neighbors. This is great. Just think about how much of what you care about is furthered by good companionship, good comradeship, good friendship. Which, of course, starts at home, in here. Yeah. Being a good companion and a good friend and a good comrade to yourself. I'm so struck myself, so repeatedly, in a deepening way, by the importance of being a friend to oneself and how hard that actually is to sustain that and how important that actually is to be a good friend to oneself. You know, to be on one's own side, not against others, but for oneself. To think about the welfare, really, of the one you are growing into being an hour from now or a decade from now. Yeah. For me, there's a friend standard, you know. If I had a dear friend who had a certain set of circumstances and needs and history and all the rest of that, what would I wish for that dear friend? And then let's suppose that dear friend was me. You know, if I would wish that for that dear friend, why certainly not wish it for oneself? That's the essence of community. Pema Chodron says the root of Buddhism is compassion, which is the wish that beings not suffer. That's community right there, isn't it? And the root of compassion, she says, is self-compassion, beginning with compassion for oneself. So then the question, of course, is how to create and maintain and increase that good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship with ourselves, with other people, both intimates as well as people we have a more distant relationship with, even people that are difficult for us. And here too the Buddha has some really nice advice, and I want to share it with you. So here I'm going to read to you one of my favorite suttas, which has to do with the Buddha being in conversation with three elderly monks who kind of live with each other. So you can just sort of imagine, you know, and to some extent you have to fill in the spaces with imagination a bit. But you can imagine these three older people living together and what could possibly happen. Have you noticed that sometimes older people can be quarrelsome? You know, younger people can be quarrelsome as well, obviously, but they could kind of go off the rails. So let's see here. Okay. Where am I here? Okay, so I'm going to kind of edit out a few little not so relevant parts. So we have three people. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living at Nadika in the brick house. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila were living at the park of the Gosinga Solitary Wood, wherever that is. Okay, so we have Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila. Okay. So, one evening the Buddha comes by to talk with them. And then all three went to meet the Buddha. One took his bowl and outer robe, one prepared a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Buddha sat down on the seat, made ready, and washed his feet. Then those three venerable ones paid homage to the Buddha and sat down at one side. When they were seated, the Buddha said to them, "I hope you are all keeping well. I hope you are all comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food." They replied, "We are keeping well, Blessed One. We are comfortable, and we are not having any trouble getting alms food." Then the Buddha says, "I hope that you are all living in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." Blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Can you imagine a Jerry Springer show with like the family, who blends like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes? It's like, wow, what a, he's saying, "I hope you are." And they say to him, "Surely, Venerable Sir," they reply, "we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." The Buddha says, "But Anuruddha, how do you live thus?" And he replies, "Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me, that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness toward those venerable ones, both openly and privately." Privately in his mind, openly, perceptibly. "I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir," he says to the Buddha, "but one in mind." The Venerable Nandiya and the Venerable Kimbila each spoke likewise, adding, "That is how, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." "Good, good, Anuruddha," the Buddha says. "I hope that you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." "Surely, Venerable Sir," he replies, "we do abide diligent, ardent, and resolute." "But Anuruddha, how do you abide thus? How do you do it?" the Buddha asks. Anuruddha replies, "Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over, if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery, or drops it into water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory, I guess where they stay. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide, diligent, ardent, and resolute. I don't know. What do you make of that? To me, it's very touching and real. I think the specificity of it, no one can make up this stuff, you know. There's just the detail of it. It's very close. You can just feel it. And you can feel their sincerity in their practice. And some key phrases, you know, mingling like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes, orienting to each other with thought, word, and deed, both internally and outwardly, with acts of loving kindness, and yielding where possible, without struggle. Obviously, there's a whole line of teaching about not giving up your power needlessly, and a line of teaching about asserting yourself appropriately. I mean, there's no lack of that. That's okay, including the willingness to admonish each other for problems, that create problems. But fundamentally, there's also a willingness to yield. You know, why would I not care about what they want? Why would I not let them have what they want? Unless there's a darn good reason not to. For the greater good, why not? Yeah?
What struck me was what was mentioned was a shared life in silence, and then talking about the Dhamma, and nothing else.
Right.
That really kind of simplifies things.
Yes. Yeah, it does. That's true. Yeah.
It sounds so simple and so natural. What gets in the way from this happening on a constant basis for everybody? Well, most people.
So he says, "What? This is so simple and so natural, viewing each other with kindly eyes and everything that flows." And he says, "What gets in the way of that?" Well, I'm glad you asked that, because the Buddha has an answer. Okay? Part two. And then we'll come back. So he talks about the six roots of dispute. That's what these are. And in the interest of time here, I'll just summarize them. So he says, and again, I think it's very helpful to translate this out of, as Linda said, a monastic setting to our real life, and out of a culture 2,500 years ago to the living truth. We have the same human brain today that the Buddha was dealing with 2,500 years ago, you know. And we have many of the same conflicts in the world today. People struggling for scarce resources, vying for power, you know, politics, all that. Worrying about their children. What do you do when there's not much love anymore, but you've been with someone for a while? You know, just real life. How do you start a business? How do you keep it going? So anyway, the six roots of dispute, he says. What are the six? One is being angry and resentful. So I invite you to do a little mental inventory as I go through this list and see if one maybe applies to you. If you're ever angry and resentful, okay? Second, contemptuous and insolent. That's feeling superior, basically. You know, playing one up, contemptuous and insolent. Envious and niggardly. Niggardly meaning stingy. Envious and stingy. I think envy is a very powerful emotion. In particularly America, other parts of the world, but because of the fairly large class distinctions here, you know, as well as this ethos of that you're kind of where you landed in society is your fault, or you earned it, when in fact there's a lot of luck involved, ton of luck, notably the luck of your birth, you know, leads to a lot of envy. Think about envy. Another one is being deceitful and fraudulent, lying, not telling the truth. Another is having evil wishes, you know, or like addictions, or wrong views. and then, or attachment to your own views, holding on to them tenaciously and not being willing to budge, being stubborn and righteous about it. Right? So anger, superiority, envy, lying, problematic desires, and, you know, rigidity. Those are factors in the mind. Obviously, there are levels of factors. There are factors out there in economic systems, culture, sexism, what have you. You know, and there are factors in terms of the body. You know, when you're dealing with going to bed hungry every night, like about 1 billion people do worldwide. You know, it tends to fire up. You know, dispute, as it were. But here, certainly within the mind, I think this is a pretty good list to look at. And, you know, in my work, it's something I have done, and I continue to do, out of all these various lists or factors or grab bags, you know, of positive or negative things, I pick one or two. And I kind of stay on that one for a while. Keep it in mind, kind of stay with it. So you might want to think about, of the positives, you know, that I just read with those three monks, what's one maybe you really want to zero in on? Like, you know, viewing others with kindly eyes, maybe. The attitude of helpfulness and sharing. Or here in the negatives list, you might think about one of these, you know, anger, superiority, envy, shading the truth, dangerous, you know, unwholesome desires, or, you know, righteousness, rigidity, you know, what might be something to work on. And then to maybe finish it up a little bit, we can move more into a real discussion here. I want to talk about the six principles of cordiality, which overlap some of what you've already heard. So, actually, I think what I'll do is to simply read the whole thing here and then we can talk about it. So these are the six principles of cordiality. And so here's the Buddha talking. Ananda, there are these six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. What are the six? Here, a person maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, toward his or her companions. This is a principle of cordiality that creates love and respect and conduces to cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. Again, a person maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, toward his or her companions. Again, a person maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, toward his or her companions. Quick sidebar. It's interesting to contemplate how often we indulge mental acts of ill will, which is the opposite of loving kindness. I think of it as, you know, metta is loving kindness, basically. I think of it as anti-metta, like antimatter, anti-metta, you know, mental anti-metta. It's like ankle metta, anti-metta, anyway. So we have anti-metta. You know, it's really interesting to ask yourself how much we kind of run this anti-metta. Again, there's a place for discovering our truth by taking our position in order to get off of it, opening up to what is really happening inside. But we can often feel where we're starting to cross the line, where we're really getting into it, and it's taken on an unwholesome life of its own. In terms of the mind, mental acts of loving kindness, or not loving kindness, or occupying mental acts of loving kindness, like going around just thinking about what wonderful people we live with or work with, or, you know, how life is hard for people that bug us, that aggravate us. I probably, like a lot of people, one of the most difficult people for, or classes of people for me to do that, are people whose politics at a national level and who have a large platform I don't agree with. It's interesting to think how challenging that is, to appreciate how life is hard for them too, and how their own version of life being hard is at work in what comes through their mind. So mental acts of loving kindness. And noticing that as we do that, we benefit ourselves. You know, that's been another really big deal for me over the years, is to appreciate how much, opening my own heart and being loving toward others and forbearing and like lightening up and not getting into wrangles I don't need to get into is actually great for me. Yeah. You know that inner chatter that says, you know, don't soften because then they'll think they won the point, right? Mm-hmm. But it's a great realization to realize that if you soften, you actually win long term. You know, you're the winner. The person who grows the most wins in the game of life, right? Really. Okay, so the other three are, he says again, a person enjoys things in common with his or her companions without making reservations. He or she shares with them any righteous gain that has been obtained in a righteous way, including even the mere content of his or her alms bowl. Again, a person dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his or her companions those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblemished, unmodeled, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, leading to concentration. And last, a person dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his or her companions that view that is noble and emancipating, and leads the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. These are the six principles of cordiality that create love and respect and conduce to cohesion, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So, loving kindness, inner and outer, thought, word, and deed, and we have sharing, generosity, being virtuous oneself, and having right view, having a wise view about things, which in Buddhism really is at root that everything is changing and everything is interdependent, and that grasping after that which is changing and interdependent is leads to suffering. Okay. So what do you make of these teachings when you think of your own real world practical problems, you know, in relationships, and let's say with regard to your desire to form more community with, let's say, the people you live with or work with, or just generally know? Yeah.
Hard when you get triggered or activated by somebody who does something that is suddenly hurtful, and you go into your own, you know, world of yourself and don't think of the other person because you get caught up with your own feelings. And all these teachings really are about letting go of that,
yeah.
Clinging to your own sort of feelings or reactiveness, and focusing on the other, and the importance of being more flexible.
Thank you.
And letting go, especially the letting go of those mental.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate you really grounding it and bringing it down to earth. That's great.
Well, it's very detailed. I like that about it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of detail of principles.
Yeah, the idea of kindness, generosity, personal virtue, and seeing the truth of things. I think that's the summary, really, right there. That's pretty solid. You can kind of take that to the bank, right? and again, I just the language of milk and water, too. And yeah. Viewing others with kindly eyes. Anyway, yeah.
While you were at, this is somewhat of a fragile statement, but while you were giving the first list, I realized all of those are about lack of generosity.
Mm.
everyone.
Yeah.
And then as you were giving your second list, I was struck again. Those are all generosity.
Yeah.
And generosity is the foundation of community.
That's so great. Thank you, Rob. Yeah.
And I'll give you a more practical one too, though. I live in a small community, about 100 people, called Houseboat Community in Sausalito. And I had a visitor one day, and I have a neighbor across the way, a younger person, and my visitor said, "Gee, now and then I can hear your neighbor." I said, "Yeah, isn't that nice?"
Yeah, Deb.
I had a situation happen over the last several days where I realized I was, you know, jealous of something that was happening with my partner. But I knew it wasn't
envy.
Envy.
Yeah, envy. Right there. Or jealousy either way, but the same territory. Keep going. But yeah.
I couldn't figure out what in my life. So sometimes the process takes a while. You know, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And so then I got, you know, then I got that I was angry. And then when I was at a meditation group this morning, you know, there's an alchemical thing that can happen sometimes, and then it was grief.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was like how to, you know, sometimes you're in this, I'm in this place where I was like, I know I'm there, but I don't know really why I'm there.
Yeah. It's so interesting to balance kindness to oneself about the grief we have from factually being wronged in some way, let's say, with kindness toward the person who wronged us. Isn't that an art? How do we balance that? You know, and I think for me that's a healthy frame. Out of that balance, we may well be assertive, out of kindness for ourselves, feeling sadness or hurt, feeling pain at being mistreated, let's say, by that other person, while at the same time operating with that other person out of kindness, both out of kindness to them and kindness to self. Because treating them with kindness is a really important way to be kind to ourselves. Because when we treat others with kindness, it really comes back to benefit us, of course. And we don't throw logs on fires that end up burning us too. But isn't that a balance right there? And to think of how the frame is kindness, or as you said, generosity, is a givingness. How can I give to myself protection and support and advocacy and succor, you know, alliance? How can I give that to myself? And also, how can I give to the other person decent conduct, fair play, living by my own code of ethics, even if they're not? Right? How can I do that? Yeah.
I was reading something about the act of kindness. When the receiver of the act of kindness receives the kindness, the feeling and the endorphins and everything goes up.
Oh.
The giver gets the same feeling as the receiver. Now, the big one now is the observer of an act of kindness gets the same benefit as the other two people.
All right, that's right. You're speaking of studies in a study. I'm aware of a study along those lines. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. It's quite remarkable. Yeah, the root of community is generosity. Yeah. There's actually research and so on about how humans evolved altruism and the rewards of compassion, because they helped survive, create survival, and so forth. Yeah. Did you want to say something? Yeah, please.
Yeah, I'm just struck by how difficult it is in the work situation to build community when the person in charge of, in this case, a school within a university, is just not interested in doing that at all.
Yeah.
And doesn't show any leadership. I've been in a situation like that for a couple of years. Fortunately, this person has moved on to another responsibility within the university where he doesn't have, his talents can be used.
That was very kindly said, wasn't it?
Well, he does have them, but building community is not one of them.
Yeah.
And it's very hard when you're
you
know, within a hierarchical organization to build community there.
Yes, I think you're right. I'm struck by how much of what the Buddha was talking about has to do with local life local being, who are we looking at right this moment, or sitting next to, or sleeping with, or who's in the cubicle next to our own, and you know, to be frank, I think back on organizations I've been in where I was pushing for more community there, and was variations of discombobulated and disbelieving and angry, and probably all those things, superior, envious, and, you know, whatever else, wrong view, toward the leadership there. And years would go by. And then in retrospect, though, with some embarrassment, I have to tell you that there were countless opportunities in everyday life, in board meetings and in staff meetings and just ordinary encounters, where I could have taken it to the next level in that local interaction, rather than just being angry about how they up there. And I'm, by the way, I'm not saying I think this is true about you at all. I'm thinking about a lesson that I've learned, you know, from that scene. And I just think again and again how the Buddha is speaking, how there, we have really so much influence directly in front of us. You know, the people immediately, one ripple out from where we stand, 1 minute into the future of where we are right now, one phone call away, one email away, you know, one touch of the hand away. We have so much influence. We have so much opportunity, you know, to simply look at them with kindly eyes. What's it like to be looked at with kindly eyes? Wow, just that is so powerful. What an act of generosity to other people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, please. And then I'll move to this side of the room.
Oh.
First you.
Dominance over here. I recently had an experience a few weeks ago at a street fair where this woman walked up to me and she was proselytizing. I mean, I right away realized what she was doing, and she was offering me this brochure. And so, you know, I didn't want to take it, and I just said, wait, what is this for? And she did a little bit of her proselytizing. And then I said, well, thank you, but I'm not taking the brochure because I'm Buddhist. And she said, why are you wasting your time with that? And it was interesting because part of me, you know, I wanted to say, you know, I didn't want to say anything, you know, unkind, but part of me wanted to say something like, well, you realize that's the major difference, or one of the differences between Christianity and Buddhism. Buddhism will accept and appreciate all religions, mm-hmm. and Christianity does not. But I decided that wasn't appropriate either, so I just smiled at her and I walked away.
Yeah.
But how would the Buddha have handled my
You had a comment, and then we want to get to you. Yeah, is that okay? Just briefly, yeah.
And I'll be brief. In my business, a gentleman walked in about 5 years ago and wanted some things that I sell. I'm in the restaurant equipment business in Miami. And I went to shake his hand, and he says, I don't shake hands with Jewish people or black people. Now, I'm Jewish. So now, when I was 18 or 20, I would be crazy, you know. And, so, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, I don't blame you. He was shocked. He was shocked. He was taken back. There was the conversation could not go past that point. He didn't know what to say. Well, anyway, we did a little business. He came back a week later and he went to shake my hand. And I said, no, I'm still Jewish. Now, we became friends and he became my biggest account. My biggest account.
Wow. Yeah. You stayed water with his milk, yeah. In a sense. I mean, again, I think there's a place for standing up and all that, but again, it's the moment, but what a teaching. Yeah. I'll let that one. There's a lot we could talk about that one, you know. Maybe in the interest of time and finishing in a few minutes, we'll let it go. Well, I will say this one little thing that to me is relevant. A true story, a woman did a 3-month retreat in at the Forest Refuge on the East Coast, at Berry Center, and she was going to go home to her very fundamentalist family. I think a lot of Christians are very ecumenical, certainly some are not. So she was going probably to back to somewhere or not. And there was some trepidation, how would this be? So she goes home, and about a month later, the people back at Berry get this letter from her. And the key line in it is essentially when she writes about what it's been like to come back home after 3 months on silent retreat. Wow. She says, well, my family hates it when I'm Buddhist, but they love me when I'm a Buddha. And so I think of the difference between being Christian in that fairly narrow, you know, sense and being Christ-like, you know. That's the difference. It's a nice line. Okay, a couple more and then we'll finish.
I was going to say, coming from a long therapy background and, and struggling to learn how to confront and stand up to abuse or, you know, emotional abuse, whatever, I find that it sometimes feels inauthentic to be nice if I'm inwardly making either making judgments or being offended by somebody. Yeah. Like, it's hard to reconcile that.
Oh, it is. And I personally... I'll be here next week, and I'm going to do one more round on being nice. But then I'm going to come back and do a number of weeks on being a hard ass. So, so just so you know. But that said, you're totally right, and I think that's the tricky balance. How do we be kind to ourselves? And being inauthentic, A, is not kind to ourselves, and it's not kind to the other person either. And how do we find that right balance? To me, that's the key question, you know. And I think, in a funny kind of way, what works is to paradoxically really solidify your capacity at either end of the spectrum. In other words, for me, it became much easier for me to love people after I actually learned to really assert myself, including expressing anger on the 0 to 10 anger scale at a 10 if I had to. Like, to be able to express anger on the 0 to 10 anger scale at a 10, which was, anger was highly repressed in my upbringing, my anger. Parental anger was fine. You know, kid anger, that was, you know, the valve was shut down right there at the throat. Anyway, so, and, you know, because now I know I can do it. So I suspect, like you with that person, you had a real sense of adeptness, and you were okay, and you could be fairly nimble. You didn't have to react. Like these Aikido masters, little old people, you know, the other people are rushing at them and they just kind of go like that, and whoosh, because they know they can throw them through a wall if they want to. Anyway, and flip the other way, it's to be able to be deeply willful about love. That was another fantastically important lesson for me early in my marriage, to be willful about love, you know, to bring intention to it. Because that kind of love for me is twice loving, because you're accessing something authentic, and it's also loving that you're making an effort to access it. Which then paradoxically, when you're really grounded in knowing that you have been looking at them with kindness, you have been virtuous, you know, you are abiding in the bliss of blamelessness, not with superiority, just factually. If from that stance, it's much more easy to be very powerful with other people. And the power then has a dignity and a traction behind it. You know, it reminds me of a description of Thich Nhat Hanh as a combination cloud, butterfly, and bulldozer. And they go together. You know, his cloudy butterflyishness really enables that relentless bulldozer that can move mountains. But when I come back, especially in the second half of July on, I'm very interested in exploring assertiveness. Okay. So maybe think to yourself this week what might be a one or two takeaway from today. You know, if nothing else, you know, viewing others with kindly eyes. How about we sit for a minute? Let this kind of settle and let our own sense of community with each other perhaps sink in, and then we'll wrap for the evening. be kind.